Blog Talk Radio.
Buyers as well. Blog Talk Radio. So I think we could.
Sorry, I have
what's up, world, and welcome to Realty Universal Radio, the fastest hour in radio, no doubt about it. I'm Randy Zachary, and this is a show about real estate, about God, about life, about giving back, about being the change in the world that you'd like to see. I'm privileged to bring to you Natalie Mullinex and Realty Universal, a company dedicated to excellence. Realty Universal is a revolution founded on a very simple principle. We believe sellers and buyers should have choices. We have been a pioneer in the menu program system. More on that, of course, a little later. Natalie Mullinex, president and founder of Realty Universal, averaged over $80 million a year in sales prior to stepping back to focus more on building Realty Universal membership network. She's an accomplished speaker, writer, consultant, trainer, and, oh, by the way, mother. She travels worldwide, literally, spreading the gospel, if you will, of Realty Universal. And now, Natalie Mullinex.
Hey, everybody. I'm so happy to be here another week. And we have a very exciting show today. We've had a lot of people always question, should I buy now? Should I sell? There's so much going on in the markets. And I always believe you should get in the game no matter what the market's doing, because you just do not get in the game. Is just sitting still, not doing anything. Of course, there's just a lot of different opinions on that. But today, we're going to take the whole hour to speak with Neil Bava, and he is has an amazing background, amazing history, and they are just winning on what they're doing. He has over 1,000 units in 7 states, investing in multifamily projects. Has also developed some other systems that are going to be really interesting to listen to, I'm probably not going to throw in any breaks unless Neil wants a break, because this hour is going to
no,
fly
I don't
on
want
by.
One. Thank you for having me.
Hey,
on the
Neil.
Show,
Natalie. So, without further ado, I want to welcome Neil Bava. Hey, thank you so much for coming on again.
Thanks, Natalie. It's terrific. I enjoyed being on the show the last time. I'm delighted to be back.
Thank you. And so if you do want a break, let me know, but we'll, so, you know, you bring such strong strategic and operational experience to your businesses, and I'm going to let you tell us about why, because when you hear anyone hears your background, they're going to understand it, and you've kept the pedal to the metal and keep learning and growing and taking your experiences and putting them into systems, which systems seem to be the big key, right, to duplication, to simplification. I know you own and manage an extensive multifamily single portfolio also, right, of over 1,000 mm-hmm. units. You speak at multifamily
yep.
events, IRI events, and meetups across the country. You have students that attend your multifamily seminar series every year. Also have boot camps. You're the co-founder of the Multifamily Investing Meetup in the U.S., BAMF, with over 3,000 members. It's amazing how you're driving the syndication acquisition of multifamily properties. I'd like to know how you can do all this. That's got to be with your systems. And so tell us about how you came into doing what you're doing.
Sure. I'm going to tell you about myself, but I wanted to give you a short answer. The answer is yes. I'm able to achieve a great deal because of systems. And today I'm going to talk about some of those systems and also give people tips. A lot of people think that systems are only useful if you're running a company with, you know, we have a $150 million portfolio. We have 1,800 units now. So we bought a lot since I was on your show last, and it is because of those systems. And in my mind, systems have nothing to do with size. Any person, even if they're basically doing a single family rental, should start doing those systems. So we'll talk about that. But, you know, to answer your other question, in my background, right, I'm a technologist, successful technology career, successful technology exit, and even before the exit, I was paying crazy taxes. I'm in California. I like to call it Taxifornia. So I was paying, you know, ridiculous
yeah.
amounts of taxes, and I got into real estate for tax deferral and tax forgiveness, which, you know, a lot of technologists like me do. And I was lucky that in my job, I, you know, me part of my job, a small part of my job, I should say, was to build college campuses. These are, you know, campuses that we were building from scratch. So I learned a lot about real estate and real estate construction through that day job. And I'm one of those weird people that got into real estate in reverse. Yeah, Natalie, I actually did a $5 million new construction project before I bought a single family rental. Right? Who has that kind of a story, right? So got
that
started in reverse.
And then you had a budget too, yep. Right? You had a budget that didn't have to come out of your pocket at the time, which really helps, right? I mean, when
exactly.
You're looking at learning, right?
Yep. It was, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes, but it all worked out. In fact, the building was so successful and so central to our business that 2 years later, we basically ran out of space and had to build another building. And this time I bought, you know, my CEO and I, we bought the building behind us. That building was too expensive. We couldn't build it out. So this time we sort of did our first real estate profit share model by inviting some doctors that lived in that city to participate with us. So we basically condominiumized the building. We broke it up into 2,000 square foot office suites, and we sold each office suite back to each of those doctors and then rented the space back from them. And it worked out. It was a true win-win because these doctors, they had money lying around. Somebody else was doing all the work. We were the ones, you know, building the building. We were the ones building them into beautiful offices. And then we also were the landlord, right? So it was a phenomenal solution for these busy doctors. 12 years later, all of those suites are still rented back to the same business. I sold that business in 2013, but the suites are still rented back. So that was a huge success story and really opened my eyes on what was possible with real estate. I started thinking of real estate not just as something that I should do as part of my technology career, but as something that I should do as a full-time job. And from that point, it still took me 5 or 6 years to exit technology, right? So that was just the beginning of the thinking process. And in the time, you know, after that, until 2013 when I sold that business, I was preparing, and I was preparing by doing the single family thing. I bought 10 single families in California. I still own those. Then I bought 10 triplexes in Chicago, and I loved the scale that I was getting with the triplexes, 30 tenants, right? 10 buildings, 30 tenants.
Wow.
But I absolutely hated the tenant demographics. The tenants were absolutely awful. I mean, really awful tenants, Section 8 area. And what I learned was that I was just focused on the properties. I was focused on what they looked like on the inside and what they looked like on the outside. And the big lesson I learned in real estate, Natalie, is the area matters so much, right? The area, the demographics of the people living there, their income levels, their unemployment levels, their poverty levels, that's the real value in real estate. That's what you've got to know. And so what I said, and I suffered hugely because I invested $1.5 million, and that money was trapped there for 5 years, right? And that was those 5 years were great for real estate. I could have easily doubled that and made $3 million from it. So I said, you know what, I'm going to turn this into a learning experience, but I don't just want it to be a learning experience for me. I want it to be a learning experience for others. So what I did was I started creating rules of real estate demographics. Right? Rules of real estate demographics. And I call these rules real focuses. And I created 5 rules for cities, and I created 5 rules for neighborhoods. And I put them together into a 90-minute presentation that step-by-step tells you what are these rules, how to find the rules for a particular city or neighborhood, and how to use the rules to figure out whether it's a good city to invest in or a good neighborhood to invest in. So these real focuses, I put them together, and then I created a course out of it, which is now on udemy.com. I have about 25 to 50 students per day that take the course. It is completely free. It's completely pitchless. Nothing is pitched in the course, beginning or end. It is simply a service to the community, because I don't want anybody to ever – so anyone can go to udemy.com. They can either look up my name or just go to udemy.com/realfocus, and they can take this course. I promise you, it's incredibly powerful. It'll turn you into an
real
instant
focus?
Expert
real
on
focus.
Any city. So
okay, udemy.com/realfocus.
Hmm?
Okay. That's fantastic. I Well, let me ask, for example, if a place like Detroit, where they say Detroit's really coming up, but there's a lot of areas that are very inexpensive, would that be like, I mean, you have to run it through the system, but that would that be a place that you go, hey, maybe this is a good spot to buy, or no?
That's exactly how you use the system. So, and Detroit is a perfect example. In fact, I use Detroit in my as one of the examples in the Real Focus course, right? So when you're watching, when you're taking this course, you can see me, right? So you know it's my video on the bottom right of the screen, and then you can see my screen, and I'm doing demos. And Detroit is actually one of the places where I do demos. And my feedback to people that are listening is this, okay? At the beginning of the show, Natalie, you said something very important. You said something about timing, right? Should I get into real estate now or should I get into real estate later? Well, whether it's timing or it's location, it all depends upon measurement, right? You've got to take a little bit of time to be a little bit data-driven because the timing is never good and it's never bad. It depends on what you're buying, where you're buying, and how much you're paying for it. Those are the three things that you have control over. And as long as you're data-driven on all three of those, there's actually never a bad time to buy. There are some times that might be better times to buy. I get that. I concede that. But there's never really a bad time to buy as long as you're controlling these three factors. This course teaches you where to buy, right? And you know, it's trying to basically keep you away from the war zones, right? So for example, I'm going to use Detroit as an example. There are parts of Detroit that are recovering, but the city as a whole continues to lose population. In the course, I'll show you how to figure out the population growth or decline for any city in the U.S., and you'll notice that Detroit has lost population now for over 50 straight years. One of my core tenets is that if a city is losing population, you absolutely do not want to invest there. So as a city, a definite no for Detroit. Now, at the same time, the same principle can be applied at a zip code level, right? And in the course, I show you how to apply it there. Let's say within the city of Detroit, let's say East Detroit is coming back and has significant population growth. That rule, if you apply it at a zip code level and you see a lot of population growth, then maybe you do want to invest there. I personally am not looking to invest in Detroit, and I'll tell you why. I believe that if you say something like, we think Detroit is going to turn around in the future, we think the population is going to start growing again, the words we think imply that you're a speculator. I am not a speculator.
That is not right, exactly.
Right? To me, what I want to say is something like, over the last 5 years, these are the five things that have gone right for this city, and that's why I'm investing in it. Those five things are simply population growth, job growth, a decline in crime, an increase in income, and an increase in home values. These five demographic numbers are going basically our core to your decision making. So once again, lots of people making money in Detroit. But my question to you is this, Natalie. If you were to take those numbers and apply them to cities in Florida, then you apply them to cities in Texas, basically most of the Sun Belt, you would notice that there are lots and lots of cities where all five of these numbers are incredibly robust. Then you take those and apply them to Detroit. And you're going to struggle, you're going to really struggle to find a single zip code in the entire Detroit metro where all five of these numbers are positive. You're going
That's
to really, really struggle.
That's important, to stick with the system. Right? Very, because I've been hearing that a lot of corporations are moving there, some of them. Okay.
Well, again, I want to see a population growth. To me, I think that there's a lot of buzz, there's a lot of people talking about it. But the fact that the city continues to lose population to me sounds like, it's something to watch, right? Yes, there's a positive trend. But when I'm buying a building, it costs $20 million. I'm putting 50 investors' money in harm's way. I can't just base it on gut feeling or base it on people saying that Detroit is coming back. So for me, I tend to put my money into areas where there's a five-year track record of these five essential elements. And it's not just five essential elements, Natalie. It is how much. So in the Real Focus course, I actually talk about how much population growth is enough, because the U.S. has positive population growth. Doesn't that mean that every area,
right,
or more or less every area in the U.S. will have population growth? So I have also set,
right,
minimum benchmarks of population growth, minimum benchmark of home price growth, same for income, same for crime reduction, same for jobs. If you set minimum benchmarks, now what you're doing is you're saying, this city's okay, nothing wrong with it, but that one's better, and this one is clearly the best, right? And those benchmarks allow you to really sort the cities in order. That order changes every year. Cities go up, cities go down, some gain jobs, some lose jobs. But what I've noticed is that when I do these parameters and I teach them to my students, there's definitely a set of cities that tends to stay up there in the list, right? And then there's a set,
right,
of cities that tends to stay near the bottom. So I can tell you that cities in Ohio tend to be near the bottom of the list, and so do cities in Michigan. And then cities in Texas and Florida tend to stay near the top of the list almost all the time. I'm not biased towards these. I'm simply telling you what the list does, right?
Right.
Those two,
right,
states appear to stay either at the top or near the top of the list almost all the time. And there's not much I can change about,
right,
it, so I just try and invest in those places.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense. That's such a great tool to have, to be able to stick by that in your rate of return. And does the rate of return make a huge difference? Like, for most investors, it would? Are you able to?
I think it does. I mean, one of the benefits of investing, let's say, in the Midwest, is that you are likely to see higher rates of returns, at least on paper. You're likely to see higher rates of return than, let's say, something in Miami, right? So, you know, Florida city, an expensive city is Miami. In Texas, you know, you can look at Austin. That's an expensive city. But what I've come to find out is this, and this is even more true of, you know, single family than the world I live in, which is large multifamily, right? My investors are investing $50,000,
right,
or $100,000 each. I'm buying a $20 million building with their money and giving them a lot of cash flow. But let's say you're looking to buy a single family. So let's say here are your choices. So choice number one, you can buy it in Cleveland, and you can get a higher rate of return. Choice number two, you can buy it in you know, a really strong market that has very, very strong population growth and job growth, and your rate of return will be a little bit lower or maybe a lot lower. But keep this in mind. If you're not a fix and flipper, let's say you're somebody who likes to buy and hold for 5 years, okay? And this example is even more powerful that if you like to hold for longer than 5 years. But as long as you hold for 5 years, in your mind, just do a little bit of basic math and say, okay, on the one side, I'm going into a city where rent growth is 5 or 6 or 7%. On the other side,
okay,
I'm going to go into a Midwest cities where rent growth is 1% or 1.5%. And if a recession starts, the city that is in the Midwest, let's say, you know, in this case I'm using Cleveland as an example, is going to have very, very negative rent growth, very negative, immediately negative rent growth. Your occupancy is going to fall. Your delinquency is going to spike. Whereas the city that is doing really well was doing so well that even in the recession, there will still be some population growth, some job growth. And so your rents might flatline during the recession, going to go down, and your occupancy is very likely,
right,
not going to go,
right,
down much, and your delinquency,
right,
is not going to spike.
Right.
When I do math on these numbers, what I find is that focusing on yield can actually take you in the wrong direction. There's no doubt that, you know, if you just focus on rents versus buying price, everyone in the U.S. would only buy in Detroit because that is that's the place where you get the highest rents for the lowest prices. But the question is,
right,
if that was truly the case, everybody and their mother would be buying in Detroit. But the truth is that there's actually more properties available in Detroit than anywhere else in the U.S., right? Why?
Well,
there has to be a reason, Natalie. right? And the reason is
right,
that those numbers are on paper. What is happening is that those properties are in areas where, yeah, you might be able to buy a $50,000 property and get $1,200 a month in rent, but the tenant quality that you're going to get there means that they might only be able to pay rents 8 months a year, and then you have to deal with delinquency and eviction. Other issues that you might find is that your occupancy is low. Not a lot of people want to live in that particular area, and so once you have, you know, vacancy, it takes 4 to 6 months to get the property leased up, right? Maintenance costs in those areas are high because the properties are so low that you constantly have to put money in. What the math that I've done indicates that a lot of these seemingly super inexpensive areas actually end up generating a lot less net profit than when you use demographics to go into cities that have extraordinarily high, you know, job growth. Like, for example, today, Orlando, Florida, is a city which over the last 12 months has just had incredible job growth. Why? Probably because of hurricanes.
Really?
A lot of businesses are moving operations inland because Orlando is safer than the Florida shore. And, you know, businesses make decisions that are more rational, and they know that their insurance cost is going to go down if they were in Orlando compared to, let's say, you know, Miami, right? Because the likelihood that a Category 5 hurricane is going to hit Orlando is way lesser than a Category 5 hurricane hitting Miami. So obviously their insurance goes down, so a lot of businesses are relocating. So that's a very high-growth city, Natalie. So today, my data indicates that if I buy a property in Orlando and I buy a property in let's say, Cleveland, well, that Cleveland property is going to cash flow more on day one. There is no doubt about it, right? Orlando property is going to cash flow less. But here's what's going to happen. Over the next 2 or 3 years, business cycles go up, down, maybe we have a recession. And over time, you're going to notice that because Orlando has much, much faster rent growth than Cleveland, in about 2 or 3 years, the properties will even out. They will both provide the same amount of money. And then beyond that third year, Orlando, that property is going to crush the Cleveland property in terms of cash flow. And then, so now by the fifth year, your cash flow is much higher in Orlando than it is in Cleveland. And you've actually made more money over those 5 years in cash flow. But the big kicker is that when you sell that property in the fifth year in Orlando, the gain, the profit that you're going to generate in Orlando will be ridiculously higher than the one in Cleveland. Because profit on sale is really based on how the city is doing. And the appreciation
that makes it
in a city that is super fast growing is much, much, much higher. In my mind, you'd end up basically doubling the amount of money that you make in Cleveland over 5 years in Orlando. Now, if you go on a 10-year run, the difference is even more stark. You might quadruple the amount of total money that you make in Orlando compared to what you would make in Cleveland because of the differences in growth between the two cities.
That's amazing. So your five steps, they can learn about that. Could you give your contact information, though, also for people to contact you or contact your company?
Absolutely. So a lot of my content is free. I very strongly believe in education being free and being freely available to everybody. So I have a website. It's called multifamilyu.com. That's multifamily followed by the letter U, multifamilyu.com. My email is Neal, N-E-A-L. At multifamilyu.com. And people send me emails often asking me questions about, you know, various cities and various systems. And I'm happy to answer those questions. On multifamilyu.com are 100 webinars a year. And many of these are multifamily specific, but most of them are agnostic. It doesn't really matter. But if you're interested in single family or multifamily real estate, you're going to learn a lot from everybody from lawyers to cost segregation experts to people that are doing predictions on, you know, rent prices and home prices in the future. There's an incredible number of experts. At any given day on the website, there are webinars from 10 different experts available. These are all deep dive webinars with tremendous amounts of content, and they are free.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's just what you're, because we're here, that's what you're doing, what you've done is so fantastic to train so many. I hear a lot of California had gone up so much since they, you know, since 2008, and a lot of people seem to be taking, this is what I'm hearing through other brokers, that taking monies out of that property and then transferring them, you know, doing 1031 exchanges into other properties in other areas, which makes a lot of sense. Well, how do you, tell us, I mentioned you yesterday on our show because,
That's happening a lot because California, the market's stalled at this point in time. So it's not falling. There doesn't seem to be any gloom and doom. But it's obvious that our market has risen, you know, so much that at this point, it's slowed down. And a lot of people are basically cashing out and investing in other areas, which are earlier in the cycle, right? Orlando, Las Vegas, Phoenix are much earlier in this economic cycle than the San Francisco Bay Area is. I think of them as being in the fifth inning of the ball game, where, you know, San Francisco is basically in ninth inning or even, you know, overtime when it comes to where it is in the cycle, right? A lot of people think there's a real estate cycle. No, it's not. There are real estate cycles. Every city, every metro is in its own cycle. And while 2008 reset all the cycles in the U.S., that's the first time in history that every city in America got reset at the same time, the speed at which then cities basically went through was different. So Denver, Seattle, and the San Francisco Bay Area went through the innings of the ball game much faster. So now they're all in the ninth or the 10th inning of the ball game, whereas other cities were much slower. So Vegas, Phoenix, Orlando are still in the fourth or fifth inning. If you understand and that concept that there are cycles, you know, not one cycle, then that answers your question of why should I get into this market late? Well, you're late if you're buying in San Francisco, but you're not late if you're buying in Phoenix.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. But, Now, what about people? I mentioned you yesterday on the show. We had some questions. They were asking questions on getting in the game, not getting in the game. How you can use your Roth IRA or just a regular IRA to buy property. And I mentioned you, and hopefully some people contact you through that too. Do you find right now a lot of people, they could use a Roth IRA is a little bit is different than a regular IRA, of course, because it's after-tax money. There's income restrictions.
Right.
They can actually use that, right, to purchase an investment property and then have the money go back into the Roth, I believe. Tell us what you suggest.
I haven't had a lot of Roth
generally.
Tenants. I haven't had a lot of people with Roth. But about 20% of the people that have invested in me, over $10 million, has come from self-directed IRAs. So a lot of people take money out of their IRA accounts, they transfer them into what is known as a self-directed account, or they take their 401ks, transfer them into the self-directed account, or they do something recent, something new called solo 401k. Not everyone can do solo 401ks, but a lot of people are doing them because the goal is to basically then self-direct your retirement investments. So you can go out and, you know, buy properties yourself, or you can invest in providers like us that are basically selling shares in large multifamily, right? So what I'm doing is taking my knowledge of demographics, targeting cities, understanding their cycles, and then I'm going there and then repeating the process at a neighborhood level, right? So it's like, okay, fine. I know Tucson's a good city to invest in right now. But where in Tucson? Tucson's going to have some horrible areas. Tucson's going to have some areas that are too expensive for me to invest in. So what I'm doing is basically figuring out that Goldilocks zone in Tucson from a demographics perspective that's just right but has high rent growth. In multifamily, we don't really care about prices. We care about rent growth because rent growth is really what drives our prices in multifamily. So I'm figuring out where the rent growth is very high, the supply demand, and then I'm taking that information and buying large multifamilies. And a lot of people that have retirement accounts are basically investing that way. And they're enjoying passive income because we're providing cash flow checks to hundreds of people every single month.
That's fantastic. What's the minimum they usually need to invest when you're doing these projects? Is there a minimum or just it all depends?
It really depends on the group. Our group is very scaled, so it tends to be a $50,000 to $75,000 minimum investment. There are other groups out there, maybe less experienced, that would that allow amounts as small as $25,000. So it's rare to find this kind of an investment for less than $25,000. But there's some out there. I think
right.
that it's really dependent upon whether you want a more experienced team or if that's not as important to you.
Exactly. No, that makes sense. If they're investing, say, $50,000 to $75,000, how long do they have to keep the money in there? Basically, is it?
Most projects are for 5 years. Our goal is to sell them earlier than that. But the key metric in our mind is we want to try and double investor money in 5 years. Right now, that's getting a little harder to do. In the last 2 years, that's been harder. Why? Because prices have gone up for multifamily. And for a while, interest rates are going up. Luckily, that's no longer the case. In the last 5 months, interest rates have gone back down. But for a while, they were really getting up there. So we were telling investors, maybe we're not targeting doubling money. Maybe we're targeting slightly less than doubling money in 5 years. But 5 years is this kind of medium between people that want long-term investments, and generally those tend to be older people. They like longer investments. They don't want to invest
five years.
They want to invest for 10. And
right.
then all of the dot-com guys that I have to deal with here in Silicon Valley that think that 3 years is too long because they grew up watching all these flip shows, right? They're spoiled with all the flip shows. And so I found was 5 years was kind of this median in between the really young guys that, are from the millennial generation, the older people that think that 5 years is too short of a time to invest.
Right, right.
Personal philosophy is alongside those older people. I think that, it's better to, if the asset is doing really well, it makes sense to hold on to it a little bit longer than 5 years. But I have to listen to both sides of the audiences, hence 5 years.
I agree. Now, you have like over 1,000 single family unit properties. Are you, that portfolio, are you finding that with today's day and age, it's so hard to, we don't have a crystal glass or, to see, but you have such a good system on looking with the 5 points and what you do. Are the single family portfolio, do you think it makes sense to still keep those going, or are you looking at selling and transferring those into multifamily projects or larger projects?
So the answer is it depends, right? What does it depend on? The decision-making that a lot of people make that I find is a little bit faulty is what they do is they say, okay, I've got property A, and the property A is cash flowing at 15%, so I'm not going to sell it. Oh, my God, 15% return on investment is a lot. I can't sell this property. It's great. Then you have another property, and that one may be selling at 10%, right? And you're like, well, here the cash flow is less, but I'm going to sell this one. What I urge people to do is this. If you're thinking about, okay, I have a single family, property, when should I sell it? I'm going to introduce a new term to you, okay? It's not return on investment. Maybe you invested $50,000. Maybe it was a $200,000 property and the $150,000 loan, and you put $50,000 down, right? So your initial investment is $50,000, okay? And so a lot of people are like, my return on investment, my ROI on this, should be 10% or 15%, whatever that number is. Today, with 7 or 8 years of expansion in this particular, a cycle, a number that is much more important than return on investment is called return on equity. Return on equity, or ROE. What is return on equity? Let's take the same example, right? So you bought this home for $200,000 and you put $50,000 down, okay? So Your initial equity was 50, but let's say that home was in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, that home might now be worth $600,000, right? So now it's worth 600, and your loan's still 150 or maybe a little less, right? So your equity that is trapped in this property is $450,000. So if you keep calculating, I'm making $10,000 a year on a $50,000 investment, that is a 20% ROI. No, here's what you should be doing. What you should be saying is the equity that I have trapped in this property is $450,000, right? And I'm only making $10,000 on $450,000. Guess what? Your return on equity is a horrible 2.5%. a horrible 2.5%. Because that equity, if you take it out and you put it in somewhere else, single family, multifamily, doesn't really matter. If you do that, that you can easily, even today, in this tight market, you may not be able to get that 10%. You may be able to get 6%. But a 6% return on that $450,000 is $27,000 a year. And you're only making 10. So everything needs to be looked at as return on equity. And now you're going to find that the best properties are going to be the ones that you want to sell. Because the best properties have appreciated the most. Properties have a huge amount of equity trapped. And so your return on equity is really, really poor, even though your return on original investment is high. And that, I think, is the right way of looking at it. And if you do that, today, a lot of people should be selling buildings that they're sitting on. And they should be moving that money into a new investment, even though that new investment might be a lower rate of return. But the equity trapped is so huge, you can still double or triple your cash.
Wow.
This is happening in the San Francisco Bay Area a lot because our rents have slowed, right? But the buildings are now worth 2.5 times what they were 7 years ago. The rents are not 2.5 times, right? The rents have gone up by 50%.
That makes sense.
And so now, people are like, well, yeah, but, you know, I only put 50 grand in and I'm making 10,000 a year, or even if I'm making 15,000 a year. Wrong way of looking at it. That's not a business way of looking at things.
No, I agree. That's amazing. What about the REIT? I mean, are you kind of the real estate investment trust? Are you looking at that kind of with what you're doing? It's kind of like having REITs, basically, because you're bringing people into...
So think of us as a REIT that really works hard on the business, on each building.
That's what I
think,
yeah.
You know, I'm not buying 1,000 buildings like a REIT, right? When you're a real estate investment trust, you're a financial wizard, right? You probably started your career on Wall Street. You know, you went to Goldman Sachs or, you know, one of these big places. And then you basically learned how to generate large amounts of money, so you opened this public vehicle called a real estate investment trust. What REITs are doing, and I'm not bashing REITs, by the way. I like REITs. I think that they're doing well.
Right.
What REITs are doing is they're using data to buy at the right time and then sell. What a REIT cannot do, I mean, really think about it. They're not set up for that, right? A REITs are a bunch of guys sitting in glass towers in New York, okay?
Right.
What
they're
not doing is working hard on the individual properties. I'm only buying 10 properties because that's how many I can improve at one time. So I'm in the weekly calls with my property manager talking about, okay, maybe if we put a dog park in here, we can boost rents by $30. Okay, what about this area behind the units? Can we make a fenced-in patio here and charge $50 more?
Right.
And, oh, by the way, you've got this unit which is looking, you know, overlooking the pool. Why don't you boost the rents on this one by $75 because it's got a nice view? Now, that all eventually goes back into the investor's pockets. I take a cut, but the vast majority goes back into the investor's pocket. That process is not something that a REIT can do because they're buying either thousands or tens of thousands of properties. What they're doing is they're doing a lot of the initial math that I just showed you, right? They're making sure they're buying at a good time in a good area, and then they're waiting for that appreciation. They're managing the properties, and they're getting rents, but they can't really improve the properties as well as individual groups like us. So on the plus side, they're more diversified. I have no doubt in saying that a real estate investment trust that owns 10,000 properties is a lower risk than Neil Bauer's portfolio of 10 properties. That has to be the case. They must be lower risk. But then at the same time, the returns are going to be lower. Lower returns, lower risk. So a lot of real estate investment trusts are either just offering cash flow plus maybe an overall return of 10 or 11%. We project returns around 20%. So that's really the difference.
Wow.
You take a bit more risk with operators like us, but what we are able to send you is a monthly update of everything we did in the property that last month with videos and pictures. No REIT in the world will ever send you a picture of any of the properties that are in there. It's a black hole,
right?
You can't even call them up and say, how many properties are you holding? Can you send me some information about what you're doing with them? The answer is no. There's nobody that is going to give you that information. So investing in a REIT is like investing in Apple, right? You think Apple's going to do well, so you buy Apple shares, and then you hope that Apple will do a good job. investing in my projects is different because you are getting monthly reports about every property and what's happening with it. That doesn't mean that you have decision-making capabilities, but you have a very clear view on what we are doing with the properties.
Well, no, it makes sense. It makes total sense. And you're working hard at it.
REITs are a good investment vehicle. Yeah, I think that they're. Let me put it this way: I think investing in a REIT is better than investing in treasury bonds. So if you're, you know, if you're holding bonds, you might want to look at REITs.
Right, right. No, I understand. That makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. What about the Delaware Statutory Trust? Do you think, you know, would this be good? Is something, for example, what you're doing, you know, with a Delaware DST, I think the people have to have, I'm not sure what the minimum asset is, but they could take the that money. So, for example, if somebody has some apartment buildings or different individual single-family homes that were investment properties, they could 1031 those, and they could put it pretty much into your project if they wanted to. And I'm not sure if that would fall under a Delaware statutory trust. It sounds like it could.
No.
If it was set up properly. I don't know.
So the short answer is this, that the Delaware statutory trust, or DSTs, have one advantage, that you can sell your property, and then you can 1031 into a Delaware statutory trust. And most DSTs, the way that they're set up, you don't have to pay tax on those gains. That's not true of my properties. You will end up paying taxes on the gains, right? So that's the pro and con. But you look at the yield of most DSTs, it might be either half or one-third of the sort of yields that our projects are offering. So there's pros and cons. Once again, a DST is lower risk, and you're not paying taxes up front, but you're going to have lower yields. Now, for the moment, for many years, DSTs have been the only other choice to 1031, right? So you can either 1031 or you can basically go with a DST if you didn't want to pay taxes on your gains for that single family rental, okay? Now there is a third choice. That third choice exists for all of this year and all of next year and then goes away, okay? That choice, in my mind, is vastly superior to both DSTs and 1031s. And that third choice is called opportunity zones. Opportunity zones are part of the tax reform.
Oh, so you're getting credits, right? You're getting credits in
those
areas.
That's right. What you're doing essentially is just like 1031, you're deferring your taxation to the future. Remember, 1031 is not a tax forgiveness program. It's a tax deferral.
Right.
It pushes your taxes out into the future. Well, opportunity zones.
So you can do that in opportunity zones? Wow. Okay.
So you can – well, opportunity zones are better, and I'll tell you why. Remember, 1031, only tax deferral. DST, only tax deferral. However, opportunity zones, tax deferral plus some tax forgiveness on the original amount and plus 100% tax forgiveness on all the money that you're making inside of that project. So basically, there's three different benefits. You get a deferral, and then 7 years down the line, you still have to pay the taxes that you would have paid today, but instead of paying 100% of them, you pay 85% of them. So you're getting a 15% discount there. But let's say you project that you just invested in. You know, you invested in an opportunity zone project in 2020. You have to hold it for 10 years. So in 2030, when that project is sold, maybe your 100 grand became 400 grand. So you have $300,000 in profit, right? That $300,000 in profit is tax-free, completely tax-free. No rollover
required.
Because
you put it in an opportunity zone. So are you, when you're doing these projects, are you buying into opportunity zones and everything everywhere?
We are.
Because
my knowledge
of
demographics allows me to buy in the right opportunity zones in the U.S. There's 8,700 of them. I'm only interested in roughly 7% of them. They are, in my mind, they're investment grade. And my investors really love
it. How do you find out about them?
The easiest way is go to Google, type in opportunity zones, and you'll see lots of information about them.
You're
can
kidding.
Call me. I have opportunity zones properties. And there's other benefits. You can actually invest any kind of capital zones in opportunity zones. 1031, you could only really sell your property. But let's say you have a business,
right,
and you bought, you know, basically sold a business for $2 million. Now you have to pay huge amounts of tax on that business. Capital gains, but still a huge amount of tax, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You can invest that into opportunity zones. You can even invest stock gains. You know, you had $1 million in Apple stock, and it doubled and became $2 million. You sold it. You have $1 million in gain. Well, now you have to pay $200,000 in federal, you know, tax. Well, you can avoid that $200,000 in taxation by investing into opportunity zones. So today, for the next 2 years, they're a limited time product. You know, you get the benefits for a long time, but you have to invest either in 2019 or 2020, because most opportunity zone funds will close within those 2 years. But if you have capital gains, either from a property that you're about to sell, so, and you were thinking of 1031, look at opportunity zones as an option. Remember, 1031, tax deferral. Opportunity zones, tax deferral, plus tax forgiveness, plus 0% taxes on the gain, on 10 years of gain.
Wow.
There's no comparison.
That's huge.
Right?
That's huge.
So for the next
two years,
I think that's a better option.
Wow. Absolutely. I agree. You are just such a wealth of knowledge. You've done it. The experience is amazing, amazing. Everybody should get in touch with you and do it. This is just, you've got such a proven track record. And so many people want to know where to park their money these days, right? There's just so much volatility, so much has gone on, and you need this knowledge.
Yes. I think so. And I think that the market in the future will be volatile too, right? I don't think the volatility goes away, guys. We've kind of pushed the volatility into the future with all these low interest rates and all this quantitative easing. My if you want to hear a sales pitch from me, my sales pitch is simply this. I spend an enormous amount of my time researching trends, researching markets, researching, you know, buildings to buy. I don't think that people that are doing this 1 hour a day or 1 hour a week are going to be able to compete.
No.
You know, just like I can't compete with a group of, you know, 20 people doing it full time. So what I find is that one of the reasons why professionals will get better returns is they are professionals. They're doing this every day, and their job is to turn down 9 out of 10 opportunities, if not more. In many cases, we've turned down more like 19 out of 20. It's very difficult for an individual investor to say no that many times. But in a market this tight, that is your job, to say no, no,
right,
no, no, no. Even hearing me say no this many times is already irritating you, right? But that is the market. And that's why you want to make sure that you at least look at the option of having professionals manage your money.
It makes so much sense. Wow. I could ask you 100 questions, but it's just your seminars. So your seminars, you said they can go to udemy.com/real focus, right? But then you have
correct.
The other
if you
seminars
want to take
that they can get into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you have
so
other
the
seminars they can jump
all
into.
Multifamily U. Yeah, they're all on
okay.
multifamilyu.com. But the course, if you want to take a course about basically figuring out the best cities and neighborhoods to invest in, that's not on my website. Why? Because the course requires a lot of video content, and it made sense to put it on Udemy. My goal with that one, Natalie, was this. A lot of people, they give away to charity. Right. What I found was the biggest charity to people is financial freedom and time with their children. And when you're buying an asset in a bad market, which unfortunately 90% of the people that are buying by themselves today, that's what they're doing because that's what's available in the marketplace today. Then you lose that time with your kids. You lose that financial freedom. So the Udemy course is simply here's a free course. It'll take you 90 minutes. It'll blow your mind on what you're going to learn.
Wow.
And you're going to be able to utilize that. And you don't need to call me. You don't need to invest with me. You don't even need to talk with me ever.
You're
but
giving
this
such
information
a gift
is now
you're
in your tools in your toolkit. And you can use that to make better decisions.
You're amazing. Last year when we were, I think when you were on the show last year, there's another course too, because I, forgive me, we have been kind of revamping, working on our membership, and you know how we're only, and I've been dealing with a mother with early Alzheimer's, and you know how there's only so much time in the day, mm-hmm. right? Because I want to be able to put you out to our network more, and we've just been revamping. We thought we were going to have things going out in December and January, and here it is April, right? Things are, well, you know how time is. It just takes, time just goes by no matter what.
Yeah.
You're doing.
Always takes
so
more
I really,
time.
I'm very interested. Oh my gosh, everything takes so much time. Last year, I thought you had a course that was, just forgive me if I'm incorrect, was around $1,000 to $1,200. It was like a three-day online or something that you were offering that really, really digs into getting them in, and they can also get in and invest with you, even if it's on a smaller level until they get knowledge or possibly, is that, tell us a little bit about that just because I want them to hear and know, because some people could jump into that right away, I would think.
I think so, yeah. So it's for a subset of people. So, you know, there are some people who are like, well, you know, I want to buy a single family and get passive income, or I want to invest with Neil and get passive income. But then there's other people that say, you know, I really like what this guy Neil is doing. I want to learn what he's doing. I want to learn how he does it. Like, what are the different steps of the process? How is he finding the properties? How is he managing them? What is the metrics to do it? You know, how does he analyze the properties and figure out which ones are clunkers and which ones are not? All the different pieces of his process, I want to know those. So I teach a course.
Right.
It's $1,600. It's also on multifamilyu.com. It is a live online boot camp. And the way that I teach it is it's taught in the evenings, three times a week, seven times. So you basically have 2.5 hours of instruction. Again, no breaks, just like this call. And you're learning in chunks, bite-sized chunks. You're learning what it is that I'm doing, right? How am I, where am I investing? Why am I picking those particular areas? What am I doing after I buy the properties? How much does it cost to rehab a property? How do I manage property managers? How do I deal with tenant issues? All of that in a step-by-step course. I don't believe in fluff. I don't believe in lots of PowerPoint slides. So the course is actually a very large set of demos, step-by-step demos on how to achieve all of these things, dashboards, metrics, toolkits, which allow you to take this information and do it yourself. My focus on everything in life is that I do not, I very much like to basically, you know, give you the ability to hunt. I want to teach you how to hunt. I want to teach you how to fish. And some people will come back to me and partner with me in the future, and that's really my business model. And some people will say, you know, I get it. Okay, now I've learned how to fish. But what I've decided is the amount of time that it's going to take from me to fish is more than I want to give up. And so why don't I basically partner with you, and you can basically invest more money. So the vast majority,
exactly.
they go out and do it themselves, and I'm perfectly fine with that. So $1,600 course. It's less than a 20th of what it costs in the industry to get the same education. And you can do the mathematics on that. The best place to do that math is to read my testimonials, because a lot of my students paid $20,000, $35,000 and then came and looked at my course. And you can actually see how they're contrasting this $1,600 course to other $20,000 or $30,000 programs. I think it's because it's so prescriptive. It's very step-by-step. People really enjoy it, and they feel confident that they can take the next steps.
Right, you're doing kind of hands-on through the whole thing, showing them exactly what to do.
Very much. So it's a live course. They can see me. They can see my screen. And there are students from all over the U.S. I'm pairing them together in groups, in clusters. So, you know, Natalie is in one state, and then John's in another state. And maybe Natalie has access to equity, and John has – you know, he lives in an area where there's a lot of good projects available. Well, now I partner them together because they have a better chance of taking down, you know, their first, you know, their first whale. Because really, that's what multifamily is. It's a whale. It's easier to hunt in a pack there, and take it down. But, you know, not quite the right example, but essentially, if you're taking down an elephant, right? It's better to hunt in a pack,
right?
And you'll have more success that way because it's a big project. Buying a multifamily is like buying a business.
Exactly. You know, we only have 5 minutes left, and I could talk to you for I could talk to you for hours. You're amazing. what do you think about? the multifamily units and the older, like there's a lot of projects that are built or buildings built prior to 1978. So there could be lead paint issues. Are you on a lot of the projects? I know with the single family that's going to be residential. Are some of the and the multifamily is going to be mainly residential? I'm not sure if you're getting into commercial buildings also because I don't know. I don't know with commercial leases if they're big or not anymore because we have so much virtual working and executive centers. So I guess my question is, what's your thought process on the lead paint issues? Do you get in and renovate, or do you stay away from the older ones, or are you not worried about that anymore?
To be honest, I think in my mind, lead paint is not a major issue. It's a minor issue. It's an issue that you need to plan for. It's an issue that you need to work around. Talk to your property manager. Figure out how it's going to affect a particular property. It's not just lead paint. When you go older than that time frame, you also deal with asbestos, right? So it's not just lead paint. That there's two pieces of that. If you're moving walls, you need a much bigger budget because anytime you do penetration into a wall that has, you know, that was basically built before 1978, that could have, you know, asbestos, and which means that you're going to have to deal with companies. So with these asbestos remediation companies. So the answer there
is
that you need to spend some time educating yourself on this. Neither lead paint nor asbestos are showstoppers. But what you shouldn't be doing is basically saying, oh, Neil said it's okay, so I'm going to go ahead. No, what I'm encouraging you to do is to basically go out there, use YouTube, right? The world's largest university. Use YouTube and learn more about lead paint and learn more about asbestos. There are things you're going to have to do. There is money that you're going to have to allocate. But I think that in my mind, the opportunity is still greater in investing in those pre-78 units simply because a lot of people don't touch them because they're afraid of lead paint and they're afraid of asbestos.
Exactly.
Think of that as an opportunity because it really is. Right?
That makes a lot
people
of
think
sense.
Of that
it
as
really
like,
does.
You know, as a ghost. It's like, oh, my God. No, 1978. I, you know, that's bad news. Yeah, yes. I mean, I've owned properties, dozens of properties that were older than 1978. And I think that I've had a tenant with a lead paint issue, and we resolved it. We basically, you know, went through lead paint remediation. I think it cost about $1,700-$1,800. They had a kid. They had to take that kid to the hospital because the kid was playing with a window pane that had exposed lead, and there was a $1,200 bill. We paid it. So maybe altogether it cost us, you know, $3,000 and a little bit of headache. For a $150 million portfolio, to pay $3,000 once,
I agree.
It's not a big deal. I mean, I've had to deal with evictions 100 times that, right? And you're going to deal with evictions both pre-78 and post-78 product.
I don't know if the government still has the program because I haven't been into this for a long time, but they had a program years ago. I had a building that you could pay. It was like it would cover you for up to $17,000. It was like a lead paint program you could pay into, and then they covered you. I'm not sure if that still exists or not. But I just wanted to get your take. I love your take on it because fear, I mean, it can stop you, and I've heard a lot of issues over the years with it, but it's so different now. So that's a really great answer. And to be able to check it out and cover things. And yes, sir, we are down to the end, and it's such a privilege having you on, and I can't wait to work with you more, too. Our big thing is time, right? Time and be able to.
Well, Natalie, you have such an incredible network. I mean, the last time I was on the show, I had so many phone calls. So you've got an amazing group of people that work with you. Yeah, I'd love to work with you. I think the Opportunity Zone projects that we are doing this year are going to be some of the best and the biggest projects we've ever done because the tax benefits are so insane. So to those of you that are listening, I think that, you know, if you think that you have something to contribute there, maybe you're a builder, you're a developer, you have access to equity, you know, love to talk with you. And, you know, most importantly, I'm also sending that message to Natalie herself.
Fantastic. I'm in. I have to find time here. But, yeah, so we look forward to talking to you soon, and I'll be back in touch. And our hour flew by. See, no breaks. No breaks whatsoever. And thank you, Neil. And to everybody out there, I wish you peace.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Thank you for joining us on Realty Universal Radio. Our hope is that you are enlightened, encouraged, and mobilized to be an agent of change. Realty Universal is on Facebook. Join us there. Follow us also on Twitter at Realty Universal. And for more information, you can go to RealtyUniversal.com. Make it a great day.